Tonight's topic is kind of odd. I'm saying that it's about inner wildness, about contacting the inner wildness, the animal energies of the body. And I'm going to start by talking a little bit about the ancient myth of Gilgamesh, this ancient Babylonian myth. And Gilgamesh was a great hero, and he had a friend, Enkidu, which was described as kind of a wild man, an animal man. And part of, among the other things that happen in Gilgamesh, Enkidu dies. And Gilgamesh makes a journey to the underworld and tries to rescue him and is unable to rescue him. This relationship, this archetypal relationship between the hero and the sort of the wild man or the wild beast. It's really the same archetype we see in Star Wars in the friendship between Han Solo and Chewbacca. And you could say in a way that, of course, there's many ways to interpret the myth of Gilgamesh, but among others, it could be read as a kind of metaphor of human beings losing a certain capacity of their wildness as civilization began, as we began this project that we called civilization that was just underway in Babylonian times. And so, for each one of us, you might say that, we start to develop some sense of our wildness around 2 or 3 years old. That's where we have a lot of our early lessons in independence, as well as our early lessons around control, self-control, all that. It's when we're learning to walk and run and get into everything. It's when we learn to talk and we can, set all kinds of verbal boundaries. No, I don't want to do that. All kinds of things like that. It's also when we have toilet training. And it's a time when the second chakra is being formed. The second chakra is having a number of powerful formative experiences. The Freudians would call this the anal stage of psychosocial development. And so if you think of the second chakra as a kind of almost like a gate of, how much our wildness flows out or is prevented from flowing out, I think I would say if all of us were raised by, enlightened Buddha-like caregivers, and who could give us, constantly enlightened attunement throughout this period, then we'd all be at ease adults and we'd all be perfectly able to let go of the wildness and let that flow when it was appropriate, and then reel that back in and exhibit more control when that was appropriate, and there'd be kind of a grace in the agility we had of opening and closing. Most of us were not raised by Buddhas, at least I wasn't, and many people were not. And of course, what happens is it's very easy at that age for people to be traumatized in some way. Traumatized, and so that we were not able to open up fully or we're not able to shut off fully. Some people are so traumatized that the gate is, as it were, stuck fully open or fully closed. The people who are wounded in a way that the wildness is fully out and can't be reined in. Those people have a rough life. There might be some ways in which they're exciting and they're the life of the party at times, but they're not dependable, they're not reliable, they're very impulsive. It's hard for them to maintain steady jobs, steady relationships. In fact, the ones that have the lowest impulse control almost invariably wind up in jail. And so there are a number of challenges there. On the other side, the people who are hyper-controlled, over-controlled, well, they'll tend to be dependable, reliable, predictable, good, reasonably good employees, maybe not the most creative, but, dutiful employees, that sort of thing. But they may feel a certain amount of, a certain lack of spark in their lives, a certain inability to let go and have fun and enjoy life. And so there's sort of these two sides, and I'll say, the people who are out of control, they rarely make it to, say, a Monday night meditation group, and they're usually not the ones listening to these Dharma talks, I think. And so my focus is going to be more on the side of the over control, the hyper control, not least of which because that's the category I'm in. I would call myself a recovering over controller myself. So that's where I'll focus a little more. And I will say it is one of the tragedies of human life in some way. It's one of the fundamental tragedies about human existence that we take so little control over the things that we actually could control, and we spend all kinds of energy trying to control the things we have no business controlling and that we absolutely can't control, And among other things, certainly I can't control what anyone else says or does, for starters. I don't have control over other people. I do have influence. And I do, to some extent, I can control what kind of influence I have on others. I have no control over the events that happen around me, but I have a lot of control about how I frame those events and how I emotionally interpret those events. And so what would it mean for an over-controlled person? Well, all right, maybe a good way to say it is, I want to distinguish between, I'm using this term over-controlled, I want to distinguish between healthy self-control, which is really life-affirming, versus neurotic over-control, which is ultimately life-denying. A meditation practice, for example, is an extraordinarily life-affirming form of self-control. And similarly, a good yoga practice, a rigorously followed martial art practice, any kind of discipline like that is a tremendous, even just an exercise routine, tremendously life-affirming forms of self-control. Healthy self-control, life-affirming self-control, is something that is consciously chosen. It's chosen, we choose it and it aligns with something in our heart, something that really knows what is best for us. Neurotic self-control is based on fear. And sometimes we feel the fear. Sometimes there's so much fear and shame we don't even feel it. It's just buried. And ego is left on the surface wondering, why don't I have more ability to let go? And we're not even aware of where the holding is. And I think it's funny because, how to say it? If we're exhibiting a lot of neurotic over-control, that's due to trauma. And trauma is some kind of pain that we're holding. And it's the nature of pain that it sends up all kinds of messages that are completely overblown and distorted, And in particular around control issues. The images that might come or the fears that might come, that if I start to tap into the wild animal wildness of my body, is that I'll be completely out of control, you can imagine the headline, Mike, the meditation teacher, runs berserk, sets buildings on fire, causes mayhem, like this sort of thing. These overblown narratives that are not actually what, you know, not actually real things to be feared. Because if we, you know, if you've lived your whole adult life over-controlled, you have plenty of capacity for control. It's not like you're going to go from one extreme to the other, you know. And to go back to what I mentioned earlier, the example of Star Wars, Han Solo and Chewbacca, and I realize not everyone has seen these movies, Han Solo is presented as a character who has this close relationship with this beast, Chewbacca, this deep camaraderie and friendship. And mythologically, that represents a kind of comfort with the deep animal energies of his own body. And in fact, when you look at the character of Han Solo, similar to the character of Rick in Casablanca, there you have these men who are, they're not constrained by politeness. They're not, you know, they're not always going to just do the thing that's convenient for other people, the thing that's going to please everyone else, you know. There's kind of a rugged authenticity about them. And it doesn't mean that they're necessarily bad people. In fact, in both cases, Rick in Casablanca and Han Solo, they're mavericks, but they're mavericks with a tender heart. And there's something actually endearing about that kind of person, you know. And so what can we look at if you, like me, have struggled with over control? What are ways that you can move toward incorporating the wild in your life? And one consideration to just think about is, in a situation in which you're saying or doing something good, in which you're trying to have a positive impact, are you operating genuinely from a heart-based compassion, or are you running on an automatic pilot politeness? You know? And even though you might say or do more or less the same thing, those are very different. And in fact, for the sensitive person, they feel very different. It feels very different to receive something heartfelt versus something more just kind of automatic. You know? And so it's just something to look at in each situation. Where am I operating from? Am I operating from my wholeness, or am I operating some unconscious routine? Similarly, what do I say and what do I not say? You know, it's typical of the over-controlled person that they leave a lot unsaid. You know? And it's the thing that, you know, I know this is true and it's very important to me, but it's going to make the other person uncomfortable, so I'm not going to say it. That kind of thing. And it's just important to keep in mind, you know, are there times that you swallow the thing that really feels true to you? Are there times that you compromise your own voice because you're trying to make things safe for other people? You know, I really have a trust that there's something healing about truth. And if something really feels true in my heart and I speak that, it might be initially uncomfortable or jarring for someone else, but ultimately it'll be something good for them to hear, and it invites them to speak their truth as well, you know. Another has to do with what's our relation with our needs, you know. It can be a very conscious place to say, okay, I'm going to temporarily put my needs on pause and in a noble way take care of the needs of someone else first, you know. A lot of my teaching job turns out to be something along those lines. But again, any time that I'm putting my needs on hold, is that something I'm consciously choosing from a very noble place? Or again, is that a more automatic pilot thing of, well, of course the other person's needs are more important than mine, and I don't even get to choose that, you know, that kind of thing. It's important to remember that Buddhism calls itself the middle way. And this is because when Prince Siddhartha left and went on his spiritual quest, the first thing he tried was extreme asceticism. Barely eating anything at all. You see sometimes in Southern Buddhism statues of, you know, the starving Buddha. He's almost a skeleton. He's so thin. And he found that in that state, he was rigorously denying the body, but it caused so much distraction that he couldn't maintain the focus that he needed. And so then he veered away from that. So he had the life of complete indulgence as a child, and then complete denial. And he said neither of those are the answer. And then he said Buddhism, the middle way, where we're satisfying the genuine needs of the body, but not indulging. And that's the place that allows us to attain that, allowed him to attain the high breakthrough of enlightenment. And so there's a fundamental honoring of our real needs, and it's of course it's a funny thing about America and about the nature of advertising, all that, what are real needs and what are hyper overblown needs. I need that stereo system, like that kind of thing. Part of simplicity is getting in touch with what really are my own needs, my true needs, and living from there. I'll share that Padmasambhava was the apostle of Buddhism to Bhutan. And there's a traditional story that when he arrived to deliver the message of Buddhism to the nation of Bhutan, he arrived riding on a tiger. And that's how he arrived in Bhutan. And of course, that's a wonderful mythological image of someone so profoundly aligned with their inner animal energies, and their inner animal energies fully serving, their greater self. And it speaks to a kind of dynamism or charisma that somebody has when they're more in touch with their animal energies. Last week I was talking about presence. Someone has a much more impactful presence when one is not just intellectually present, heart present, but also viscerally present with those raw energies. Like that's a powerful presence, and a person who speaks from that place can have tremendous influence. It's funny, the spiritual path is one that calls for a tremendous amount of self-control, but it also requires a certain amount of wildness, And again, I'll go back to the foundational story of Buddhism. Prince Siddhartha, he grew up, he was being groomed to be a king like his father. He grew up in tremendous luxury. He had a few experiences as a young man. And at a certain point, he decided the incredibly wild move, I'm going to walk away from everything I know. I'm going to walk away from everything I know and be a renunciant. And of course, we know how the story ends. The story is he goes on to be the Buddha. But that young man, in that moment of walking away from everything he knew, he didn't know where it was going to go. That was a totally wild move, a move of just letting go of any kind of control or any kind of, any kind of previous conception of safety. And that's an extreme example. In Christianity, we find similar examples of the call of the apostles, and Jesus says, "Come, follow me," and people drop everything and follow Jesus. That's an extreme example, but it's an interesting question. What is the small move of wildness that you are called to do as part of your own spiritual growth right now? What is the small risk you are called to take so that you are occupying more of yourself? And so it's just a good question to hold. So with that, I'll share the quote sheet. Oops. I need the thought I had the address of it. Okay. Here we go. And so first I have four one-liners from Rumi, who of course has a lot to say on this topic, you know. The first one is, I want to sing like the birds sing, not worrying about who hears or what they think, you know. How much do we hold back who we really are and hold back our authenticity and our power because of what other people might think, you know? You know, no one goes to their deathbed worried about what other people thought, you know? The second one, grapes want to turn to wine. That one is just, that's so wonderful. You know, what is a grape? It's something neatly cultivated. A grape is very sweet. You know, children love grapes. You know, what is in you, sweet and childlike, that wants to just turn a little more wild? Sell your cleverness and buy bewilderment. Of course, cleverness is very much a head word, very much a trying to control the world in your head sort of thing. And bewilderment is more a state that we're in when we're confronted with the wildness of life and the wildness within us. And of course, this last one, which is famous, out beyond all ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there's a field. I'll meet you there. You know, and how much are we controlled by right and wrong and good and bad and all that? You know, and can we actually get to the wildness beyond those judgments? Tolstoy said, I wanted movement and not a calm course of existence. I wanted excitement and danger and the chance to sacrifice myself for love. And the prophet Khalil Gibran wrote, but you, children of space, you restless in rest, you shall not be trapped nor tamed. For that which is boundless in us abides in the mansion of the sky, whose door is the morning mist and whose windows are songs and silences of night. You know, and it's a great question. Are we in touch with what is boundless within us, that which we cannot control? The poet Gary Snyder said, off the trail is another name for the way, and sauntering off the trail is a practice of the wild. This is also where, paradoxically, we do our best work, but we need paths and trails, and we'll always be maintaining them. You must first be on the path before you can turn and walk into the wild. There's something very profound there. Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh, who later became known as Osho, said, take hold of your own life. See that the whole existence is celebrating. These trees are not serious. These birds are not serious. The rivers and oceans are wild. And everywhere there is fun, everywhere there is joy and delight. Watch existence. Listen to the existence and become part of it. Tom Hennen said, help me to be in the world for no purpose at all except for the joy of sunlight and rain. Help me keep close to the edge where everything wild begins. You know, and again, it's always a good question. What does it mean to live at my edge? Am I living at my edge right now? Carl Hyacin said, that's what people do when they find a special place that is wild and full of life. They trample it to death. You know, and that's certainly true of, you know, pristine nature places and that sort of thing that can get overrun by you know, humans who want to see it. But in some sense, it's also true of places within us, you know. Can we leave alone what is wild within us and let it be as it is? Tara Brach said, if your hearts are ready for anything, we are free to be ourselves. There's room for the wildness of our animal selves, for intimacy and understanding, creativity and productivity. There's room for spirit, for the light of awareness to suffuse our moments. The Tibetans describe this confidence to be who we are as the lion's roar. Michael Pollan wrote, but wildness is more than a quality than a place, and though human beings can't manufacture it, they can nurture and husband it. The gardener cultivates wildness, but he does so carefully and respectfully in full recognition of its mystery. The poet David White said, he's talking about destiny, and he says, it's still our destiny, our life, but the sense of satisfaction involved and the possibility of fulfilling its promise may depend upon a brave participation, a willingness to hazard ourselves in a difficult world, a certain form of wild generosity with our gifts, a familiarity with our own depth, our own discovered surprising breath, and always a long practice and robust vulnerability equal to what any future may offer. There's a lot in that quote. John Eldredge said, what if those deep desires in our heart are telling the truth, revealing to us the life we were meant to live? God gave us eyes so that we might see. He gave us ears that we might hear. He gave us will that we might choose. And he gave us hearts that we might live. The way we handle the heart is everything. Susie Kasem said, every creature was designed to serve a purpose. Learn from the animals, for they are there to teach you the way of life. There is a wealth of knowledge that is openly accessible in nature. Our ancestors knew this and embraced the natural cures found in the bosom of the earth. Their classroom was nature. They studied the lessons to be learned from animals. Much of human behavior can be explained by watching the wild beasts around us. They are constantly teaching us things about ourselves and the way of the universe, but most people are too blind to watch and listen. Nikita Gill said, some days I am more wolf than woman, and I am still learning how to stop apologizing for my wild. That's really big. To what extent do we apologize when who we really are shows up? Victoria Erickson said, half of me is filled with bursting words and half of me is painfully shy. I crave solitude, yet also crave people. I want to pour my life and love into everything, yet also nurture my self-care and go gently. I want to live within the rush of primal, intuitive decision, yet also wish to sit and contemplate. This is the messiness of life, that we all carry multitudes, and so must sit with the shifts. We are complicated creatures, and ultimately the balance comes from this understanding. Be water, flowing, flexible, soft, subtly powerful and open, wild and serene, able to accept all challenges, yet still led by the pull of steady tides. It is enough. There's a lot of second chakra wisdom in that quote. Michael Xavier said, wild things have restless wings that too often need to fly. Another great question, what in you needs to fly and is being held back from flying? Carl Fornhand said, it's time to be wild again. Take a prophet or poet on a journey and float out into the mystic. Dive deep into the mysteries of your life and let yourself sink long enough to know only what can be imagined, not defined. Take a step out into the desert with those who have ventured there and find mystery and paradox and nuance, not certainty and doctrine. And finally, Sobhya Cherbase said, this is what it means to become wild again. It's to peel back the niceties of society. I have had too many of these, the niceties. I have become one myself, a person like a platitude, pleasing and flat. Wow.